The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. This week, Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats finally announced plans to formally pursue impeachment.
So what is at stake is our democracy.
We'll take a closer look.
This is not a vote of impeachment. It is a vote on an impeachment inquiry.
And 1 year out from Election Day, we'll look at the field of candidates in this populist moment.
They haven't formed a winning coalition to date.
We'll look at the killing of the terrorist leader and head of ISIS, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
He was driven by very clear theological convictions.
And we'll hear from a mission leader to the Muslim world.
When you think of a major religion that assaults John 3:16, some of us just get angry for the glory of God.
We've got all this and more. Thanks for joining us. I'm Georgine Rice, your host, coming to you from my home station of KPDQ in Portland, Oregon. You can hear my own program live each weekday afternoon on 93.9 FM here in Portland and online via our website at kpdq.com. It's great to be with you. We'll begin in our nation's capital and the subject of impeachment. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi released a letter to her House colleagues that her caucus would formally bring a resolution of impeachment to the House floor. But it may seem like old news. Haven't the Democrats been pounding the drum on impeachment for months now? Well, yes and no. Their inquiry to date was never brought to a floor vote, and thus they never formalized the process. And the formalization matters. We'll let our next guest explain. Jeannie Zeno, a professor at Iona College in New York, joined Kevin McCullough on AM 570, The Mission.
So let's talk about the timing on Nancy. Did she do it to chess piece Donald Trump's two big wins of getting the two ISIS leaders in the weekend attacks? What was at play there?
Yeah, the timing is curious that it came after that. And I think she's also feeling some pressure because there has been a mounting, you know, talk, and not just amongst conservatives, but others saying that you should formalize this. You should, you know, put on the floor what you are resolving to do. And of course, they have said it will entail the process and procedures for moving forward on this impeachment.
But to be clear, it will not be the introduction of the articles. This is simply the confirmation that they need to have Congress's approval to get this thing started officially. I mean, it's what she should have done 4 weeks ago, right?
Absolutely. And to your point, this is not a vote of impeachment. It is a vote on an impeachment inquiry, which should tell us things like, what are the terms for the public hearings? Now, we know there's been a lot of debate about those so far and behind closed doors. You know, when are they going to disclose all these transcripts of depositions they've been taking? What are the procedures for transferring evidence from the Judiciary Committee? What are the president's due process rights? All of those questions people have should, I emphasize should because we don't know yet, be addressed in this vote that they're going to take in whatever the resolution is going to entail. And so, again, we need to see what the language of that is. But it's going to be a vote on the inquiry. It would have to go to the Judiciary Committee to draw up the articles of impeachment and then go back to the floor for a vote on impeachment itself.
Let's talk X's and O's for a second. Red states, blue states, well-defined states, they're probably not moved by any of this. In fact, if anything, I think the super secret behind closed door process has aided the president in his narrative of saying this is, you know, calculated and it's rigged and it's all against him. How does beginning the inquiry formally impact that equation?
You know, I think the president and his people have been focusing on process. I think they do need to focus on substance.
With the president embattled over impeachment and with the onslaught of elite media that is certain, just certain, that there has to be some impeachable offense somewhere with this man, you'd think that President Trump's chances for re-election would be pretty slim. But then we look at the lineup of candidates pursuing the nomination to run against him a year from now. Zelina Zito of the Washington Examiner has done some of the best reporting on this tense, dynamic, and polarized period in the American political scene. She was a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Selena, don't you wonder, listening to Hillary Clinton talk now, but not just Hillary, pretty much everybody who's on the other side on that, you know, Democratic stage that has to be, you know, 100 yards wide to fit everybody. Everybody sounds like they did 3 years ago. I don't feel like any of the Democrats really learned how they possibly could have lost to Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's it's like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, we're repeating it over and over.
And that on issues that are important to average votes, not to what's important to the sort of chattering class or the white elites, which is, it appears, is who they are speaking to and to the media, but to both Democrats, Republicans, and independent voters, their issues on Medicare for All. Suburban voters aren't going to like that. You live in Upper St. Clair or Fox Chapel or Swickley, and maybe you didn't vote for a Republican in 2018 or in the midterms, or maybe you didn't vote for Donald Trump. But if the platform becomes that it's Medicare for All, then you lose that health care premium that you earned, right? You earned that. You worked really hard for that. The same goes for middle-class union families, right, that maybe don't live in places like Fox Chapel or Upper St. Clair, but they, you know, they're all around Allegheny County. And, you know, a lot of these men and women have stood on picket lines to preserve good health care for their families and for themselves. And for that to be taken away, and it's Medicare for All, I feel, you know, in my conversations with these voters, that that's the wrong path for the Democrats. Right. That does not mean that they will vote for Trump, but that does mean that they will sit at home, sit on their hands, and or vote third party. The party can't, these are the same sort of missteps that Hillary Clinton made nearly 4 years ago.
Right.
And I also think, Selena, that looking at the kind of the Democratic strategy since Trump has been in office, there's been so much push to get him, to impeach him, to embarrass him. But if they, right. I feel like if the Democrats would have spent half that amount of energy trying to do some serious self-assessment, like, how did this happen? What happened in the 2016 election? How did we get so off course? How were we so sure and we ended up being so wrong? If they would have put 50% of the impeachment effort into that effort and coming up with good, solid candidates, look, this next election would look completely different.
Well, I would take it a step further. I would say not only should establishment Democrats been more reflective, and but I also believe that establishment Republicans, the ones in particular who sort of frame themselves as never Trump Republicans, if I were a member of either group, I would have sat down with my colleagues and said, "Oh dear God, they picked him over us. What have we been doing wrong?"
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is something that both subsets of sort of anti-Trump or resistant voters and or strategists or elected officials, that if you screw something up tomorrow, or if I screw something up tomorrow, I have to face it. I have to look in the mirror and say, how did I screw that up and how do I fix it?
Right.
There's none of that.
Selena Zito's with us. Selena, I want to ask you then, if establishment Republicans haven't done that, if Democrats haven't done that, are we just going to see the next election as just a rehashing of 2016, even with the impeachment scandal and the impeachment, you know, all the stuff that's going
on?
And
the socialism.
As it is.
Well, I think have the Democrats sort of gone with someone or someone had stepped up to run for the party that isn't, you know, far left and isn't speaking past the voters, you know, people are complaining within Washington, D.C. They're saying, oh, well, all you're worried is about white working class. I just spent a week and a half in the South. You know, African-American voters in South Carolina are not thrilled with anyone that's on this stage, with the exception of Joe Biden.
Hmm.
So it's not just about white working class voters. You know, these candidates are incredibly appealing to the, you know, white sort of elite liberals, but they're not all that appealing to a winning coalition. You know, you win the presidency by putting together a coalition.
Right.
They haven't formed a winning coalition today.
So, Selena, I don't understand this. I mean, people who are running for political office spend, no matter what, you know, where you are, money on political consultants, those men and women who, you know, eat, sleep, and breathe politics 24/7. How can they be so wrong engaging middle America and, you know, focus on the elites on either coast? What is that all about?
That's easy. That's so easy. They don't live in middle America. Mm-hmm. They don't know anybody like your listeners.
Hmm.
You know, they don't know anybody like them. Look, these political consultants, the political class, whether elected officials or strategists, the bulk of them, not all of them, but the bulk of them, the ones that run these big, large elections, live in the super zip codes in this country that are mostly located in places like Washington, New York, or Los Angeles, Silicon Valley. They don't share the values, nor do they understand people who live in the middle of the country. I have always argued that both political parties should move their operations out of Washington, D.C., and maybe put the Democratic National Committee in Cleveland and the Republican National Committee in Columbus, Ohio, because they need to also understand the people that actually vote for the people that they're running.
I see. Okay. So now, but this is still having an effect. This is still having an effect in America, because when you look at what's, you know, what's happened with the Democratic Party, with AOC and the Gang of Four and all that. Now, here locally in the city of Pittsburgh, longtime Democrat office holders, Stephen Zappala, Mike Doyle, they, for the first time, are being pressured within the Democratic Party, right, to sort of come out and really actually campaign for the first time in a long time. They're feeling that pressure from those new young elites to reinvent themselves in some way. What do you think?
Right. So Zipkin Tapala, unless I missed something, got across that finish line with his progressive challenger in the primary last April, May.
Yes.
But Mike Doyle does face a primary challenge coming up this coming April with the Jerry Dickinson. And so these are the fractions within the Democratic Party that we really don't explore much, because the Democrats are not in power in the White House. But they're very real and they exist. And it will be interesting to see, you know, where they go. Look, if you look at the exit polling data from AOC's race versus Crowley's, you will see that she won white elites. Hmm. She did not win working class whites, and she did not win minorities.
Coming up, the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
He was driven by religious impulses, by very clear theological convictions.
Albert Mohler, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. The Christian Outlook podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at christianoutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. It was Sunday morning this past weekend when President Trump announced that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, had been killed. The news should have been greeted as a matter of consequence, similar to that of the death of Osama bin Laden in May of 2011. It was a major win in the battle against Islamist terror, generally, and ISIS in particular. For Christians, it was also a reminder of the fall and the spiritual battles playing out on the world stage. Albert Mohler explains from his briefing program.
The entire story of the Islamic State and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and the story of his demise, all of this brings to light something that Christians must never forget.
After Genesis 3, we live in a violent world. And in some places of the world, at virtually any time, there is a violence that defies human imagination. But of course, the Islamic State, under the leadership of al-Baghdadi, established a reputation for terrorist acts that, shockingly enough, went even beyond previously horrifying terrorist groups such as al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, we remember, was responsible for the terrorist attacks in Washington and in New York City on September 11, 2001. But the Islamic State took the argument of Al-Qaeda several steps further than Al-Qaeda. For example, the Islamic State under Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi took the use of media beyond anything imagined by Al-Qaeda, particularly the newly developing social media and, of course, the use of video. Some of those videos showing those horrible images of Western figures being beheaded or otherwise executed by the Islamic State, clearly intended to send a message of terror not only there in the Middle East, but throughout the entire world. The threat undertaken by the Islamic State was that its tentacles could reach just about anywhere. And also, unlike Al-Qaeda, it was not isolated into cells that might be identified and isolated, but rather it went to the worldwide Islamic movement, inviting young people, particularly young men all over the world, to take up arms and explosives and any form of weapon and to undertake terror attacks even without the authorization or planning of a central command. The other thing to keep in mind of the Islamic State is that it did claim to be, and at least for some time was, a caliphate claiming to be a defined state, that is, a government that would control territory. Al-Qaeda made no such claims, nor did most previous Islamic groups that were identified with the pattern of Islamic terrorism. We now know that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi gained control of the group that would be known as the Islamic State, and he remained the most visible expression and the most influential leader of the Islamic State until the American commando raid on Saturday night. There are so many levels of worldview importance that are revealed in this kind of story. First of all, you have the fact that virtually everyone around the world, though ready to debate whether or not evil actually exists, seems to put that argument on hold in order to identify the fact that whatever Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was, he was evil. The modern mind in the West is now so disarmed when it comes to intellectual combat that many people, particularly in the intellectual elites and amongst the academics and the analyst class, they are hard-pressed to explain how anyone can actually act in this way, and they try to find some explanation outside the human heart in abstract cosmic forces or more likely even in sociological or historical arguments. Christians understand that sociology and history is always a part of the equation, but the problem isn't going to be found in history, and the problem isn't going to be found in sociology. The problem is going to be found in the human heart. And those who watched those videos or had any impression of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi during the last several years, they came to understand that he understood his acts to be justified for a greater good, the greater good to be the establishment and the expansion of the Islamic State. And he also openly threatened the United States, saying that one day the flag of the Islamic State would fly over the White House. And there's every reason to believe that al-Baghdadi had confidence that his vision would become true. That is because as we try to explain the evil represented in this kind of personality, we come to understand that he was driven by religious impulses, by very clear theological convictions. This was not merely a terrorist state. It was declared to be the Islamic State. Here's where we face another of the major confusions within the Western world. There are so many who want to say that the issue here is not Islam. Rather, it is merely Islamic terrorism. But we are talking about Islamic terrorism because it is particularly and genetically Islamic. And furthermore, because those who are making the argument for Islamic terrorism are actually claiming to read word for word and to obey line by line the teachings of the Quran. Thus, they represent not only a terrorist threat to the West, they also represented a theological challenge to other Islamic cultures and nations. Al-Baghdadi was clearly driven by the conviction that Islam had been seriously weakened by a loss of its fervor and, furthermore, the loss of territory that was officially ruled, as was the caliphate that he established under the name of the Islamic State.
The death of al-Baghdadi is only a fresh reminder of the challenges of radical Islam and the challenges presented by the Islamic world more broadly. Gospel witness among these nations and these people groups is sparse, and the Christian laborers looking to bless these people are few. Bob Blinko helped with the establishment of Frontiers USA, the only missionary organization specialized exclusively in reaching the Muslim world. He was a guest of Eric Metaxas.
Arguably, the needs are greatest in the world where Islam has introduced Sharia law to so many people. And how do you solve a problem like Sharia?
You're talking about things that most Americans, we don't think about it, right? That there are actual human beings living under circumstances where it is illegal, extremely illegal, dangerous to accept Jesus. So here in America, we kind of debate, well, I don't know, do I believe in Jesus or I don't know what I believe. Like in those countries, if you dare think for yourself, your life is threatened. Mm-hmm. And so when you say you go into these countries or whatever, what can one do in a place where it is literally illegal or even punishable by death to become a Christian?
Yes. Let's think about the need that drives us into these places and finds people that really want to make a difference where the needs are the greatest. When you think about a religion which assaults every single phrase of John 3:16 and assaults the glory of God in his love, in his desire to have the Son of God die on the cross that we might be forgiven, and in his desire to deliver people from darkness. When you think of a major religion that assaults all of that, some of us just get angry for the glory of God. Others of us are angry because of the abuse of women, the child marriages. When I spoke to my high school graduation comrades just a week ago, Eric, they were completely nonplussed, you know, what I do as a missionary to Muslims. But when I put it this way, we are against child bride marriages. We are against female genital mutilation.
Well, just to be clear, when you say child bride marriages, yeah, how young are some of these marriages that are happening in these countries?
They are pre-teenage or very young teenage girls against their will to older men who paid the father. And we are for the end of slavery because Islam still has never broken with the concept and the reality of slavery. We are against the execution of Christians when they leave Islam. These outrages are something that my high school friends could understand in a moment and say, you know, go man, go, even though they didn't quite resonate with the Christian faith that drives me.
But see, this is the whole thing, is that any idiot who hears this immediately gets it. You don't need to be a genius. You don't need to be a Christian. But the point is, most people will never hear this because what we call the mainstream media never covers this.
Coming up, a gift for the Kurds.
The United States government took mercy upon the Kurds, and I went in to help translate and relocate people.
More with Bob Blinko when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they're preparing leaders for the public square. It might be the right step for you or the recent college graduate in your life. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
I'm the one who held the net.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Georgine Rice. The Kurds have been in the news in recent days after the abrupt decision on the part of the Trump administration to remove some 1,000 American troops from the region. The Kurds, many of you will remember, have been key allies in the war on terror, and they're spread throughout portions of Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. But the Kurds have been in the heart and mind of Bob Blinko for more than decades. I think you'll enjoy a different sort of news about the Kurds as we return to Bob Blinko with Eric Metaxas.
What was the issue between Saddam Hussein and the Kurds? I was never clear on why that was the case. Is it that the Kurds simply wanted to be free of Iraq and would not stop fighting, would not accept his conditions?
The Kurds spill over four countries in the Middle East. They don't have any Kurdistan that's recognized, as you know, and northern Iraq is one of those. So for 30 years, the Kurds had been resisting Saddam and victims of his chemical warfare. This the world should never forget, that this man bombed civilians with chemicals. And the Kurds were terrified that that might happen again. That sent them to the mountains on Good Friday, 1991, away from the oncoming onslaught of Saddam. It was into that crisis, when 1,000 people were dying every night up in the mountains, that the United States government took mercy upon the Kurds, and I went in to help translate and relocate people.
But under George Herbert Walker Bush, it seems that we abandoned the Kurds at the end of that war. Am I mistaken?
Well, there was an encouragement to uprise against Saddam by that administration. And then when they tried to uprise against Saddam and were beaten back, the U.S. didn't come to their rescue until it was almost too late. But they did come to the rescue, and they started Operation Provide Comfort. That's how we got into northern Iraq and protected the Kurds with a no-fly zone for several years.
You know, the courage and the faith that you exhibit by living much of your life in that part of the world is an inspiration to everyone. And I want to ask you, do you see miracles? Have you seen miracles happen in the years that you have been over there?
I have been pleased to be now the president of this mission agency for some years. And so I am able to see the miracles, not only where I was. When you think of deliverance from evil, this is a sign that people have do use to turn to the living God. But I think of my missionary colleague, Randy, who knocked on a gate in a town west of Karachi. And upon knocking to this gate of a home where he expected a hostile reception, the person opened the gate and said to him and his friend, "Are you here to tell us the truth about God?" That sent a hair up on the back of Ed's neck, but invited in with that kind of an opening, this fellow who let him in, let's call him Cornelius, explained that he'd had a dream about God that previous night, that someone would knock on the gate of their house and tell them the truth about God. So Cornelius, the Muslim from Pakistan, he opened up all the doors of the bedrooms, asked his family to come into the living room, and told them what had happened. In that setting, they all looked to Randy and were able to hear the gospel. We have a picture of the whole family dripping wet because they all decided by the afternoon to be baptized. That was a sign. That was a dream which drove him and his whole family from a hostile state into a state of willing to accept. And that man, Cornelius, and his brother have gone on to create what we are referring to as a movement to Christ of more than 1,000 Muslims.
In Karachi?
Yeah, in Pakistan. Because they have been brave and true and suffering and willing to push on in great danger in order to bring the hope of Jesus Christ in a place where missionaries cannot go anymore.
I remember Ralph Winter, the missions, the missiologist, who you said was your PhD advisor. Is that right?
Yes.
I remember him, and when I took this Frontiers for World Missions perspective course in 1989 in Black Rock Church in Connecticut, I remember hearing these things, and I remember first hearing about the so-called 1040 window, that if we want to bring the whole world to hear the good news that Jesus died for them, not just for white people in the West, but for them, we're going into places where there's tremendous opposition and tremendous demonic opposition. I'm guessing you've seen some of that.
So this 1040 window is an enormous rectangle that you see on the map in the area where 10 and 40 on the Mercator map would show up. And yes, when we see
40 below the equator, yeah, 10 above.
Yes. So when we see the people delivered from Islam, it's always accompanied by a miracle or a sign. We are taking our teaching on this from Romans chapter 15, verse 8, where Paul says, "I venture to say nothing except what Christ has done through me as a missionary to the Gentiles, to win the Gentiles to the obedience of faith through word and deed and signs and wonders through the power of the Holy Spirit."
For the complete conversation with Bob Blinko and for a link to the Frontiers website, go to ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up, help on the Christian journey today from a man who yielded his life to Christ in the 4th century A.D.
Our hearts are restless
until they rest in you.
You'll enjoy this next segment of the Christian Outlook, so stay with us. The Christian Outlook podcast is brought to you in partnership with Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose religious freedom is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-654-3969. That's 800-654-3969, or click on the banner ad at christianoutlook.com. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Georgine Rice. Augustine, St. Augustine, Augustine of Hippo. These are a few of the names we hear for one of the more profound thinkers of the early centuries of Christianity. He is, without question, a theological giant, a figure whose work is today revered by both Catholics and Protestants. A figure who lived a millennia prior to the Reformation and yet shaped the life and thoughts of Martin Luther and much of the Protestant world. But Augustine is much more than an intellectual giant. He is, first and foremost, a sinner saved by grace. James K.A. Smith calls him a man who knows where home is, where rest can be found, what peace feels like, even if it is sometimes ephemeral and elusive along the way. Mr. Smith wants to take believers and seekers on the road with St. Augustine, the title of his latest book. He was a guest of John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Jamie Smith has spent some time hanging with St. Augustine, and he wants to introduce you to Augustine himself. I like the style of it because it sounds like you're trying to introduce him to me.
Great. Yes. I mean, the hope is... I think there's a lot of people for whom this ancient figure, he might be vaguely a name that they've heard of, but they've never imagined him as a possible sort of companion on their journey. And he's been that for me. And so I guess I'm trying to invite people to join us.
Nice.
So your pronunciation is Augustine. We started with Augustine. Should we follow you?
So there's a debate. There is some debate about this. We should talk about it. So I would say... A lot of Protestants say Augustine, I think. I did my doctorate at Villanova University on the other side of your fair state. Villanova is actually a Catholic university that is run by the Augustinian order. So there's Augustinian priests like that are in charge. And they all say Augustine. So I learned, I thought, oh, maybe I should learn to the Augustine. But I'm ambivalent about it.
Let's talk about the ancient African. That's the label that you put on Augustine. Mm. Who was he? When did he live?
Augustine lives in the late 300s and early 400s after Christ. So a long time ago, he's a very ancient figure. He's not from the Middle Ages. He's from late antiquity. And he is born and raised in North Africa, which at that time was a province, an outer province of the Roman Empire. His Confessions traces his journey from North Africa because of all of his ambition trying to get to Rome and Milan, where the emperor was based. But then eventually what happens is he returns home to Africa and never leaves again. So one of the things that's really remarkable, and again, I think a lot of contemporary American Christians might not appreciate this, but that one of the giants of Christian theological imagination after Jesus and Paul is an African. And so much of the theological framework that the Reformers, for example, that the Protestant Reformation was also indebted to, goes back to this ancient African from whom I think when you read him today, he still feels so contemporary because he's, in a way, a great psychologist of the human heart. Mm.
So Confessions, in many ways, considered sort of the first theological memoir, which, you know, he was a product of the time. He went out like a lot of young men and sowed his wild oats. And then he confessed, right? He sort of came clean and found his way into a life with Jesus.
But after a long way.
Right.
Yeah. And Augustine was like pure frat boy, you know, like he absolutely was. He was sort of, you know, he went to Penn State. He wanted to be the big business tycoon. He wanted to be successful. And he also sort of is really interested in sex, drugs, and rock and roll, so to speak. And what happens, I think what's most interesting about Augustine's story is not that he does those things. That, again, is a perennial feature. It's actually that he achieves everything he sets out to do, and that in a way, it's almost his success that becomes the source of his disappointment. That's when he really has to sort of open himself up and to realize that the things he thought was going to make him happy, the things that he thought would bring him meaning and fullness, all of his achievements, all of his ambition, all of his sort of conquest, they left him empty. They didn't satisfy. There was a fundamental lack of satisfaction, and that's what then becomes the portal for him to be encountered by God.
So what will the Augustine quote, Jamie, is our hearts are restless?
Until they rest in you. Exactly. And this is why, I mean, sometimes I say Augustine was kind of a Manhattanite 1,500 years before New York existed.
Right.
But that's just to say he's like so many of us who have big dreams, high hopes, all kinds of ambition. We want to accomplish things. We think that will make us happy. And you get to the top of the mountain and you look around and you're like, is that all there is?
Right.
And
that's
where he has to start asking himself, am I looking for love in the wrong place?
Augustine is kind of the perfect travel mate, right? Because he's already been down the road that we're halfway through.
Yes, exactly. And he knows something about our restlessness, as John said. He knows, like, so often our restlessness is a symptom of a certain dissatisfaction and unsettling nature of what we've become. And he honors that. He takes that seriously. It's why it's also very telling that this Augustine, who thought the happiness was found in, you know, conquest, who thought that happiness was found in chasing everything, ultimately came to identify happiness with rest, with no longer having to perform, with being liberated from proving and being able to rest in, in fact, as he put it in one sermon, to rest in the Father's lap and to realize I'm not valued because of what I do or what I accomplish. I'm valued because I'm in the Son.
And isn't that the most current message that we could read? I mean, especially if you know anybody, and I know you know a ton of them, who are between the ages of, what, 15 and 25? And it's amazing what we're doing to a particular generation, and then what we're getting out of it is kids that are, you know, strangled with anxiety and depression and every other mood disorder that nobody ever talked about 10 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And the way you put it is exactly right. It's the world we made for them. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't their fault. And I teach at a university, and universities across the country are experiencing epidemic proportions of mental health challenges in students, anxiety and depression. And it's because we've created this performance anxiety that starts when they're young. In some ways, I've seen it most intensely in Ivy League institutions. And I think that's where the word of the gospel, which says you are loved not because of what you do, but because you have been found. You know, that to me is just such a timely way to articulate the gospel in a sense.
Coming up,
once you love God, then you can receive all of those good created things as the gifts that they are meant to be.
Stay with us for the final segment of the Christian Outlook. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Georgine Rice. Boys in the Boat is the book that tells the story of the Washington State rowing team and their terribly unlikely and gloriously successful trip to the 1936 Olympic Games. They won the gold, and yet each of the oarsmen rowed facing backwards. They got where they wanted to go by looking behind them. That's what James Smith is trying to do for his readers, looking back in order to get where we want to go today. Let's return for our final minutes of James Smith with John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
I got to bring up this quote, though, because it's exactly what you were talking about. This is early in your book. You write this: the irony is that we experience frustration and disappointment when we try to make the road a home rather than realizing it's leading us home. That's really the heart of what you're saying.
Yeah, because the way Augustine frames this is he thinks a lot of this is about how do we relate to creation itself? And the problem isn't the good things of creation. It's when we sort of glom onto them or hang on to them as if they were everything. So when Augustine says, you know, you have made us for yourself and our hearts are restless until they rest in me, what he means is our hearts have this sort of infinite longing and capacity that can only be satisfied by God. And what happens is when our loves are sort of disordered, now we sort of look to created things as if they could satisfy like the creator. But you don't have to like hate the world in order to love God. It's like once you love God, then you can receive all of those good created things as the gifts that they are meant to be.
Oh, that's good.
One of the reasons why I think Augustine is so timely is because I actually think we are reaching a point in this kind of secularized experiment in which people are realizing that materialism is not returning what we hoped for. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Like, I do think we see this evidence of these kinds of cracks in the secular where people are starting to realize that what they thought would be a this worldly meaning isn't enough. Like, they have a sense that there's got to be something more. And in that sense, I mean, it might be hard to watch, but in some ways, disappointment is sort of the gateway to grace. That's certainly the way it worked in Augustine's own experience, right? Was achieving everything that he had hoped for and then realizing, oh, it just sort of melts in his hand and it's not what he was hoping for. And sometimes I think what's important is that Christians learn how to be alongside our neighbors in the midst of that disappointment and not necessarily come to them and say, aha, or let me give you the answer, or here's the message, but rather saying, hey, I see you're hungry for something. I would like to introduce you to someone. And that ultimately that someone is the father who is always there to welcome home prodigals who've tried everything but. And that seems to me at the heart of the gospel.
That wraps up this edition of The Christian Outlook. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Google Play by going to ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. A final thanks to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom, for executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posehn, and Mike Cook. I'm Georgine Rice. Join us again next time for The Christian Outlook. Today.